we push very, very hard to have either a co-founder or one of the first hires be someone who can really think about brand.
This is a Better Product original series on product brand. I am one half of your normal co-hosting crew, Christian. And before we jump into the episode, I want to pause and invite you to join our upcoming speaker series. It's 5 weeks, 5 speakers, with countless product insights starting on October 28th. You can register by going to betterproduct.community/speaker-series. And if that's too long of a link to remember, just go to the community site and you'll see a link there to get connected. So for this episode on product brand, we are joined by Emily St. Dennis, head of platform at Female Founders Fund, a VC firm that invests in women building category-defining businesses. We stumbled upon Emily from an article she wrote called Why Brand Matters in VC. Now, I know why she thinks so, and we'll explore that here in a minute, but being, you know, partly my show, I want to share why I think brand matters or should matter in the VC world. So one of the things to understand before we dive into this is that I imagine most of you are outside the VC world. Some of you may be VCs, but I think predominantly our listeners, their only interactions with VC are maybe for raising funds or just sort of reading about big investments. But on the product side, what's important to understand from the VC lens is that a lot of traditional venture capital has been driven by, you know, financial metrics and has not really crossed paths with brand only until fairly recently in the last several years. VC is, you know, decades old, but I think in this new wave of technology, a lot of the products are having to build and grow in much different ways than they were even 10 years ago, but definitely when you think even in the early 2000s, we are still in a phase of technology where you could build products that almost like digitized, you know, paper or made office workflows a lot faster that had never seen technology in that way. In this new world, the bar has risen. So a lot of those things are digitized and we're actually talking about optimizing things or solving more niche problems. All that to say that brand and design are much more important for products to grow today. The other thing to understand, now again, this is my interpretation of the VC world. I am not an investor myself, but in the due diligence process where investors are really looking at the background of a company and looking at their financials and their legal side and their HR and their operations, all of these specifics, a lot of times what gets glossed over is the product side, particularly on the brand. This is important because I think that brand enables a lot of the other business functions. It's something that my agency Innovate Map has talked a lot about separately, where it's not just the visual side of brand that we see as consumers or end users or buyers, but when you think about brand for building a product, it actually enables you to grow much more efficiently and be able to scale a lot more. If you can build deeper relationships with customers, it makes it easier to sell, makes it easier to market. If you can build a strong brand that makes marketing jobs easier, marketing becomes a lot cheaper. It's a lot easier to leverage a strong brand than to have to market a weak brand. So it's really challenging to find the ROI and metrics that you could really cover in the due diligence that investors always do for new investments. But the reason why we wanted Emily on this program is to really cover that side, because she's one of the few of a growing number of investors that really understand how brand can become a business driver and really help companies grow a lot more efficiently. So enough from me. Let's go to Emily and learn, how did she go from being a child psychologist to working in tech? And what does SoulCycle have to do with her journey into brand?
I decided that I was going to kind of try to spin my experience a little bit in a way that, you know, maybe I can edge my way into like the business world. And so I kind of just pitched my experience as consumer insights. And so I got a job at a media agency here in New York City doing a lot of their strategy and analytics work. And so I basically just for the first two and a half years post-college worked on a bunch of different new business pitch decks. And for me, that was a great experience and kind of learning how to think about telling a story of a brand. But for me, I think through that period of time, I realized that the advertising world wasn't what I was looking for. And so I was living in this like hole in the wall apartment on the Upper East Side that was like had no windows and was just rough. And it was 2013 and there was a SoulCycle studio, just like a boutique indoor cycling company that opened a couple blocks south of that apartment. And someone gave me a free pass. I took a class and I was like, I've never experienced anything like this before, and was just really excited and super energized by the empowerment aspect of what that experience felt like. And for me, that was kind of like the respite for a job that I wasn't super excited about. And kind of throughout that year of going once a week, I realized, why don't I try to work at the place that I like to be? And so at that point, you know, SoulCycle had probably 8 studios, and I ended up getting hired there. And I think that like started off just how excited I was about being involved in early stage startups. I think just like the hustle of being able to be involved in something that was growing so quickly and something that I believed in so deeply that, you know, I could actually build the future of what that looked like was something that I was really proud of.
After SoulCycle, Emily connected to a private equity company that invests in health and wellness companies. And the rest is her story.
And over the course of the year, really worked on a really granular level with the business owners on how to improve their metrics and how to work on new client acquisition and existing client retention, different marketing campaigns, everything from what the branding should look like to what the retail should look like to just what our strategy should look like as a long-term vision for the brand. But I think through that experience, I realized that if I really wanted to make an impact, I needed to get in early stage. So that's when I started learning a little bit more about VC and seed stage investing. And I thought that a role in Platform was the best suited role for me, where I could really optimize my operations experience and be able to learn much more about really portfolio support, what that really means to work with a founder one-on-one, what branding looks like. And I've been running operations and Platform for the fund for about a little over 2 years now.
She took it upon herself to learn about investing and was able to work with strong brands while being exposed to the startup space. It's safe to say her experience inspired the vision of the Female Founders Fund. Say that 10 times fast. In this episode, you'll hear how she thinks about brand while sharing the development of their own.
Well, first off, I think it's important to note that what we're building is something new. So back in, you know, while investing in female founders is like trendy and more relevant in the past couple of years, when Anu started the fund in 2014, that was not the case, even in city as progressive as New York City. So she was definitely hitting the wall when it came to us getting investors, but she's a female founder herself, and she has started a couple of companies. And so she really understood what it meant to give people the resources that they need to be able to build the companies that we believe are building a future that we want to live in and be in. So for us, I think thinking about Female Founders Fund as Anu is an operator, I'm an operator, and historically, most, at least Silicon Valley-based funds are run by investors and VCs. We think about what we're doing a little bit differently. So while, of course, we're a VC, we are operator-led and run. And so we run Female Founders Fund in many ways as a brand as well. And what that does for us is, because we are a concept that sometimes still trips some people up, that we invest exclusively in female founders, that we need to build our own brand to be able to do 3 things. One is to increase our access to deal flow. So the more people that know about us, the more people that see us, the more people that are familiar with us, that means we get more people reaching out to us and saying, hey, when I am thinking about starting a company, Female Founders Fund should be the first thing that comes to mind for them. The second is, for us, when we're fundraising, we need to make sure that we're well respected in our own ecosystem. So of the people that are in our network, that we can still punch above our weight class in terms of leveling ourselves with funds that have hundreds of millions of dollars higher than us in assets under management. So how can we level ourselves even if we're a $26 million fund? And then the third is supporting our portfolio. So the more people that know about us means the more people that are finding our companies the more people that are trying our companies, the more people that are applying to work at our companies. And obviously that helps us ultimately, because the goal is getting those companies acquired and helping them grow and scale as quickly as possible. So that's the reason why we think about running Female Founders Fund with the focus on brand the way that we do.
So dissimilar to digital products, VCs don't have as many like attributes, logos. I mean, we see a lot of brand kind of product integration. When it comes to thinking about brand for a VC, especially for a fund, how does that kind of manifest itself?
So I think historically, again, I really do think about dividing up the funds that you're thinking about in terms of investor-led and operator-led. So investor-led funds, historically, you'll see when you go to their website, of course, they have a logo, but really their investments kind of speak for themselves. They've had many more years to ramp up. They have a very connected network of people because of the amount of years and because of how much time they've had to be relevant in the ecosystem. And so for us, I hate the term catching up, but I think that there's something to be said for we need to be thinking about not only how to highlight our portfolio, but how to highlight ourselves so that we can really meet the level of where some of these other funds are when we're only 6 years old. For us, having a differentiated aesthetic helps us stand out and situate ourselves a little bit better. So we just make sure that everything that we put out into the world explains quickly who we are and what we do. So we just went through a brand refresh back in the spring. And so we redid our website, we redid our logo, we kind of optimized our brand colors, all of that. And so that whole process for us was like, if we're going to pick a logo, what we need that to communicate is a level of strength. And I think you can see from, it's an F logo. And we went through so many different versions of that to kind of be able to say, like, we believe that investing in female founders is simply good business and that we have the stats to back it up. So for us, kind of looking at the website when you first log on, highlighting kind of what our track record looks like of strong returns. So that's the first thing that you see. Spotlighting the women behind the investments on our website's portfolio page was really important to us. And then again, kind of what our logo mark looks like, what our fonts look like, all of our imagery kind of has a level of like strength and assertiveness, which is something that was really important to us to communicate through all of the mediums that we're interacting with people on.
There's two things I want to talk about. One is platform, because I've been seeing more people that are directors of platform, and I never heard of that. I mean, in software, you think of like platform technology. And so I just assumed it was that. But I have since learned before we started talking that it's not that. But I feel like it might be worth talking a little bit more about that, because your community and what you're building as an extension of the brand of Female Founders also seems like something that's it's happening a lot more in the product space, which is a sense of community or building around that. So what do you mean by platform? What is that for yourself and for startups?
It is definitely one of those titles that kind of grew out of necessity. And I think now it's an umbrella term for all of the things that aren't investing. Although there are some platform roles that do like a half and half, like some investing, some platform. So what I would say is, the easiest way to think about it is it's all the stuff that's not investing. And then what I would say is it really means different things at different funds. And that's dependent on who and what you're investing in. Depends on how big your fund is and how big your firm is and kind of what your goals are in terms of how you want to focus and build your reputation in this space. So for us, what that means, you know, it's anything from ops to talent support to working with our founders on a one-on-one basis on pulling comp surveys for them or getting feedback on who's the best brand partner for them to work with as they're building out their website. For us, we're super community focused. And so that's building out a robust event series, writing content for our blog, developing a podcast, managing all of our socials. So it can mean a lot of different things. And so I would say what I'm seeing more is their Lehrer Hippo, which is another fund that's based in New York City, does a great job of thinking about how to divide up what platform means for them and really get experts in those areas. So the way that they have their platform team set up is basically with their director of platform, who kind of oversees and runs strategy for them. And then underneath her, there is someone who exclusively runs content. There's someone who runs talent, and that's talent placement for all of their portfolio companies. And then there's someone who does kind of like events and operations. So I think that is kind of where I'm seeing from operator-led funds, that's where I'm seeing things going. But I think it really depends on what your goals are in terms of the impact that you want to make at your companies, and really like focusing on what you're good at and great at, and really making sure to pinpoint that instead of trying to do a million different things at once.
So shifting to the companies themselves and how you advise them or how you work with them, you talked a lot about brand, you know, for yourself and that importance. We have a lot of people listening to the show that are in early stage startups. And I would say most of our listeners are probably not brand experts themselves, but it's a theme we're trying to hit on more because it's, I think, the importance of it in the technology space and consumer space is just increasing day by day. The importance of consumer preference and consumer demands are increasing. So I'd love to hear your perspective coming from the VC side and then your own background. As you're advising early stage startups, how do you help connect the importance of brand to the early stages? And if it can help, I can also give what I sometimes hear as pushback is like, we'll worry about brand later. We've got to focus on, like, I hear sometimes like, yes, that's a thing we're going to do, just not right now. So how do you sort of combat that and get people to take it seriously from the very beginning at a seed stage company?
I would say a lot of what we do as such early stage investors is we're investing at the end of the day in a human being and an idea. And so a lot of times, you know, yeah, we'll see a deck, but many times there's nothing that's been built yet. Sometimes there are communities that have traction and growth, so we can get a sense of what the vision is, but it's incredibly important to us that the founder is, you know, if they want to categorize themselves as a true operator, and that's really what they're great at. They're great at ops. They're great at making things happen. They're incredible saleswomen. That's amazing, but we push very, very hard to have either a co-founder or one of the first hires be someone who can really think about brand for them. I think one of the advantages of us being small and us thinking about brand and the importance of it in terms of VC is that we are going through the process ourselves alongside our founders. So we're connected to some of the best talent in New York, which is where the majority of our founders are based, because we're going through the branding process as well. So a lot of times we're connecting our founders with people that we've worked with directly because we can vouch for how differentiated their perspectives are. And we have built out an expert network. And so that's a group of about 100 people who have volunteered their time to help our founders on, you know, one of five things that they believe that they are an expert in. And so we had a breakfast for our founders on the importance of brand right before COVID. That was like one of our last in-person events. And that was with Albert Lee, who's a design partner at NEA. And he was at IDEO. I think he was managing director at IDEO before he was at NEA. And he did kind of just like a whiteboard session with our founders about how to think about brand. And one of the things that I took away that I thought was like one of his best points is he said, if I were a founder now building something new, I would go weird. And he's like, I think there's a generation of startups that were like, we really love the red antler look of like things being very millennial and things being very clean. And I just love that he was like, I would 100% go weird thinking about fonts, thinking about colors. How can you stand out in a way that's like the exact opposite of what you've been seeing over the past 5 years? So that was an approach that we took, obviously not weird because we're a financial company at the end of the day. So we had to be a little bit more streamlined. But for us, it was about being differentiated. We don't want to look like some of the other startups that we've seen over the past couple of years. We want to have a differentiated aesthetic, and that's really what we push our founders on.
I can vouch for that. I mean, we have brand designers in our agency that I think they always want to go weird. And I think at some point, if it gets too popular, it won't be weird anymore. But have you seen Oatly's, anything about like Oatly's brand? Are you familiar with that company?
I love everything that they're doing. I'm vegan, so I'm a big fan of all of their marketing. But like, that's a perfect example. Also, like, you know, Ugly Drinks, the like
I've soda seen that cheaper. Once, yeah.
Like that is, I mean, that's really, and of course it depends, you know, are you a healthcare company? Maybe it doesn't make sense for you to have branding like that. But if you're a consumer company, I mean, one of our brands, Kin Euphorics, they're a-
Also kind of weird. Are,
yeah. So-
In
so
a good way.
That,
yeah.
Yes. And that's great that you're familiar with them. But so for people that don't know about them, they're a, she really dislikes the word non-alcoholic. It is a drink that is supposed to make you feel really great. And is a social cocktail that doesn't have any alcohol in it. But she, I mean, talk about a branding visionary. Like she is, they've kind of went retro with like fonts, imagery. It's very like 70s, all of their color tones and the way that they kind of came out with a brand video, I think at the end of the year around the holidays, that was just like, it looked like it was filmed in someone's, you know, parent, having a party in someone's parent. Like basement. So I think thinking about what's everyone doing and what can I do to really think about what makes us unique is where I see most people standing out. Another good example is Billy, the razor company. Georgie, her background's in brand and marketing, the founder, and some of their most successful campaigns have been showing women with body hair in razor ads on New York City subways or in Times Square, huge billboards. And she has really punchy colors. And I think just the way that she's thinking about like, I don't need to do what everyone else has always done. I'm going to do something completely different is really where we see the people that at least get lots of, I think, respect and admiration from a generation of people that are looking for something different.
How do you connect this to maybe the world of B2B SaaS? I know you all invest in fintech and B2B. You have a lot of consumers. A lot of your examples, obviously, consumer-based, like, you know, Kin and Billy, and these are all people's names. These are real things. If you haven't heard of these, I promise you, these brands are real. Kin and Billy. But yeah, so when you think about that and then take it to the B2B space, I think we're getting to a point where people understand that you don't have to have the stodgy buttoned up brand with B2B, even with enterprise now. But I still think that people are challenged saying, okay, I'm on board. I really like Weird. I like Oatly. These are neat. But how do I do this if I'm building software for, say, HR professionals or some back office, you know, software, something like that? So does the conversation or advice change when you're talking brand in those types of markets?
I think at the end of the day, you are building something for the person that is going to be consuming it. So if you're, I would just, two companies that we've invested in come to mind. One is Maven Clinic, which is an online clinic for women and families, and Bento Box, which basically hooks up, creates a platform for restaurants and the hospitality industry. And so at the end of the day, yes, of course, there are going to be people that have access and interest in these companies from a individual standpoint. But if Maven's goal is really to work with bigger companies and provide resources for all of their employees, for example, then I would really be thinking, if you're looking at a Bank of America, and that's like your end goal is to sell into one of, you know, a bigger bank or something like that, you need to keep in mind that it takes, and we've had to do the same thing with Female Founders Fund. Our investors are, you know, a little bit more old school, a little bit more traditional, as most LPs are. And thinking about how can we stand out while still resonating with some people that, you know, are coming from a more buttoned up culture and perspective. And so I think that's kind of, for us, at least for me, my job is to pair our founders with the right branding agencies and the right connections to make sure that they are walking that line of something that feels really new and different, but can still be appropriate for the consumers that they're trying to attract.
Let me ask you one final question. If people want to learn more about you, about the Female Founders Fund, or any of the portfolio companies, what's the best way for them to do that?
So definitely visit our website. It's www.femalefoundersfund.com. That has everything from who we are, what we do, which companies we have invested in, resources. So lots of great materials on how to create a pitch deck and how to think about term sheets, how to think about your first hires. So that's a great first place to stop.
It's really refreshing to have the investor's perspective in this series on brand. Emily was fantastic. You know, representing female founders for one, I think is a very rare thing, as she mentioned. So that was really cool. But also to hear the investor side of brand, which I think you don't often think about brand and investing on that side of startups, but hearing it from her side, I think is really compelling. And I thought she brought up a different perspective on brand. What stood out to you the most from what Emily talked about?
I liked hearing her break down why the Female Founders Fund has such a strong brand. You know, getting a little background too on kind of where it sits and as far as like the history of VC funds and how they are so strongly like very well-established investment VCs will they let the portfolio shine through the logos of the portfolio because they've been around, they have a lot of street cred. And it sounds like for Female Founders Fund, because they are younger and they're still kind of building that, you know, she laid out kind of the three reasons they have such a strong brand. One, their increased access to deal flow. Like they've got to get themselves out there so people know who they are, so they will come to them. They'll be top of mind for people. So it is kind of that, like, it's almost like reverse pitching to these startups. They'll be like, they use their brand to say, we are a place for you. We're, you know, you're going to want to work with us. The second reason being that it helps them punch above their weight class. Again, it helps them, you know, level themselves up. And I think this is something we tell our clients a lot. I think this is something we talk about a lot, that a great brand can make you a competitor in a space that maybe you're not quite yet. You could be a two-person company, but if you, you know, if you look like you belong there, if your website speaks that way, people will buy your product because you look and feel legit. And then that third reason of supporting her portfolio companies, the more that Female Founders Fund can get out there, the more people learn about that. They learn about the portfolio companies. They want to work at the portfolio companies. They want to try the portfolio companies. So I really like how she kind of broke that down.
Even as you were talking, I was actually, in looking at their portfolio, thinking of maybe almost like a fourth reason why it's important for them, which maybe they know or don't know just because they're on the inside, but it starts to create a sort of expectation for the types of companies that they invest in. So as they've had this focus, if you go look at Female Founders Fund's portfolio and just start clicking on a lot of these links and look at their stories and then go view their sites, the way a lot of these companies are talking, their visuals, their logo, it all kind of, they're all very different, but yet somehow they all sort of fit. And so I think it's interesting from a founder's perspective, like if you're trying to get money, you look at that and you don't just see the F Cubed logo that they have, but you actually look at all these portfolio companies and think, oh yeah, this is what I want to be amongst. And so it's not, it's like part of it is their brand has then been manifested in the way that they have higher expectations on brand from startups. They advise on that sort of thing. And then now it creates a strong perception amongst founders, which I think will make it easier for them on the deal flow to find not just good deals, but maybe like the right deals or the right companies. So that's really just interesting to hear you talk about it and triangulate it with her and then looking at them, think, yeah, this actually all feels very like them, which I don't think you see that with a lot of investors. I think sometimes just like all over the map, like you got one really big company that looks like the website was designed by someone's like nephew. And then you've got another one where their brand's really strong and it's kind of all over the map, not this one.
Do you think it's more common or do you think it's more relevant to have a strong brand when you are like a more mission-driven fund?
I guess since nobody can disprove this question you just asked me, I would just say, yeah, I would say it probably is because I think brand, as we are covering in this series, it requires a perspective and it requires a confidence in, you know, upholding that perspective on things and expectations that you're setting with how you're going to interact with a consumer. So if you take all that, it makes a lot of sense if you're on a mission, because if you're on a mission, you can't be bland or you can't be generic. I mean, you have to, like, your mission has to come out in your brand. So I think, yeah, I guess I would answer that and say, yeah, what do you think? Would you also say yes? Do you have evidence to prove or disprove?
Yeah, I would also say yes. I'll show you my evidence later, obviously. But I think that so what brand is so good at is conveying aspirational things, right? Of I want to feel like this, I want to be like this. And I think in mission-driven investment funds are very aspirational. They're taking a stand, they're saying the world is a certain way and we want it to be a different way. We want more like she said, like F cubed is she said it is our alpha strategy is that investing in women pays off. Investing, you will get a higher than average return investing in women. And so I do think a brand has to represent that. Otherwise, you know, I guess it's kind of like dust in the wind, you know?
Well, and I think too, I don't know if we're covering this on the series or not, but we talk a lot in product, and we talk to like product managers about the importance of focus, like not just what you're prioritizing, but what you're not prioritizing, or knowing your users so well that you know who your target user is, but also who your target user is not. It's similar with the brand. I think these brands can be, you know, very well defined so that it's very clear who it's not for. It might be too weird for somebody, or it might not resonate with somebody, but I think we see those same product principles that you and I have covered for like, I don't know, almost 2 years now with product managers and designers and user researchers. We're seeing that play out even with brand, where these distinct brands are also doing the same thing. They're making it very clear who they're for and who they're not for. And I think to your point too, what's interesting is catching the ones who might not resonate at first, but might aspire to, and sort of get into some of the customers that they might not have otherwise thought would resonate with the brand. So I think it's just powerful hearing what you're talking about, how it can create that focus.
I think that ties too to what she kind of talked about with the B2B versus B2C brands, you know, keeping your buyer in mind, you know. And I know you love the idea of things being very millennial, but what were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think it's funny, the weird and standing out. I don't know if it's a strategy or if it's something situational. I think a lot of the brands we even mentioned are operating in spaces that are highly competitive, like Oatly brand is the way they can differentiate amongst a bunch of other sort of nameless milk brands or non-dairy based milk brands. And that may not be true with all the B2B SaaS, but I think her points about understanding your brand too and understanding how to translate it for different audiences is important. So, you know, maybe, and I don't know what the right answer is, but maybe if you have one of these very, you know, strong or really distinct brands on the external, but when you get into the room with people when you're selling or you're like nurturing prospects for your B2B platform, there might be other ways that the brand can come out that are maybe not as in your face or maybe not as weird as some of your other materials are. Or you might start playing with slight variations of brand based on the channel. You know, maybe the way you speak on Instagram is slightly different than the way you speak on LinkedIn, because even if it's the same human on those, it's kind of like two different expectations. Like one's like an upscale restaurant, one's a dive bar. You know, there's just, I'm not saying Instagram's a dive bar, but that would probably be Twitter, I think, based on the way the conversations go. But hopefully my point made sense.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you're looking for more resources on how to design, build, market, and sell better products, then head over to betterproduct.community to join the community. And as always, we're curious, what does better product mean to you? Shoot us an email at podcasts@innovatemap.com.